We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're very glad to have you with us. We're pleased to have as our guests in this first hour of the show today, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He is an economist with quite a lot of experience in Washington. He's also been an academic. He's taught at Princeton and Columbia. He served as the chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors to President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2002. Then he went on to serve as the director of the Congressional Budget Office, 2003 to 2005. He also was appointed to be a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, that commission that was set up to look into the financial crisis that began in 2007. He served as chief economic policy advisor to the McCain presidential campaign in 2008, and early last year he became president of the think tank American Action Forum. He's visiting the campus. He gave a talk yesterday. This was the annual Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and he's spending some more time here, but be talking to students, and was good enough to come and spend some time with us. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can send your question that way, will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start out maybe and to talk about the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. This was appointed, the members were appointed by the Congress. They were six Democrats, four Republicans, right? They were appointed by the leaders of the House and the Senate. You were appointed by Mitch McConnell. The first hearing took place January last year. Then the report came out January this year, right? And it was definitely divided, divided result. The Democrats put out one report. Three of the four Republicans, and you were among them, put out a dissent. And the other Republican put out yet another dissent. And one of the things that I read was that early on, you had said that you had hoped this could be a bipartisan effort, and that the result would there would be a nonpartisan result, and it didn't turn out that way.
Much of my life has not turned out the way I planned.
what would you say led to this very fundamental disagreement among members of the commission as to what really is the root cause of the problem? Is that just basic competing economic or political philosophies among the members?
I don't think it's that so much. I mean, we were constituted even the year before in April and ultimately started business in July. And if you look at the entire record of our meetings, this was not a partisan exercise for the bulk of it. It was 10 people from very different backgrounds who had disagreements. I mean, there's no question about that. We didn't uniformly agree on where to focus next, what was big, what was small, all the things you might expect people to disagree about. And what I always try to remind everyone is that it's really not shocking that we disagreed. I mean, we're still fighting about what caused the Great Depression, and it's been a little while since that happened. So, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 is a complicated event, and people are going to disagree. One of the pieces of good news out of this is we will leave behind an archive of testimony, depositions that we took, documents that we either subpoenaed or got from government agencies, and future historians can go back and make up their own mind. I mean, I think that's probably one of the great pieces of value that we ultimately produced. But as time went on, we started looking at drafts, and you know, it's like everything else. You can talk, but the proof is in the pudding. And as we looked at drafts, we started to see the divisions really sharpen and emerge. And ultimately, I felt that the two sort of storylines that were emerging, one by Commissioner Wallison, a Republican, was basically that it was all government housing policy that caused this. It's much too simple. I disagree. The one that was pushed by the majority was that essentially it was everybody's fault. And if it's everybody's fault, it's nobody's fault. I thought we owed the American people a better explanation than that. So Commissioner Keith Hennessey, Vice Chairman Bill Thomas, former member from California, and I felt it was our job to come up with a list of causes, and we came up with 10. And I'm not sure everyone will agree with us, but we felt it was the right middle ground to come down on.
Well, let me ask you this, because in reading about it, I guess it's sort of my perception that the basic difference between the Democratic majority and then you and your colleagues that formed that part of the dissent, the big difference was that what the Democrats were saying was this crisis was entirely avoidable, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, then my understanding
they did say
what
that.
You're saying is that that in fact, no, that it was unavoidable, and it seems that they were stressing the actions of individuals, and what you were stressing was the actions of economic forces. And I'm sure that there are some people who would say, well, that's still like saying no, you know, it's still like saying, well, it was really nobody's fault.
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly differences in emphasis, I think, come through real clearly. Big emphasis in the majority report on individuals and institutions, you know, Goldman Sachs this, AIG that, particular regulators X, Y, and Z, whereas we felt that a fair reading of the evidence was that it would be a mistake to rely too much on that and to focus too much on the U.S. because we, in fact, saw some of the same phenomena around the globe. We saw housing bubbles in Australia, in Spain, in the United Kingdom. We saw, quote, bailouts, Northern Trust in the United Kingdom. We saw bad mortgages, even in places that didn't have subprime, Alt-A. We saw collapses even in places that didn't have securitization, all the exotic securities. So to focus on those things seemed to us to miss the point, that this was a phenomenon that, in fact, was much more complicated than just bad mortgages by people who weren't regulated because Wall Street greed drove the world. I mean, that narrative struck us as incomplete, and our narrative is not very sexy. We admit that, but we think it's right.
Yeah. Well, though, does that mean, given if you do say, yeah, it's really a much more complicated thing, market forces, but what about that question of whether or not it could have been prevented? I mean, even if that was what was happening, should not somewhere along the line have there been an opportunity to do something so at least perhaps it wasn't so bad?
So we think it took 10 things going wrong to create a crisis. Yeah. And we think they were all necessary. And so could this particular crisis have not happened? Yeah. We could have not had a housing bubble. We could have not had, terrible risk management at large financial institutions. We could have had all sorts of things that did or did not happen. But in the end, it is the ultimate nature of finance to do two things. Number one is to borrow short term. When you put deposits in a bank, you can go get them the next day, and lend long term. And so there's always a mismatch. They've made loans for, you know, periods that are often 30-year mortgages, and they've done it with short term borrowing. And if the people want their money back, you have a mismatch there. That's a problem. And the second thing is you do something safe. Your deposits are considered very safe, and you invest in something risky. So there's always a mismatch there. And so finance is extremely susceptible to panics and extremely susceptible to these kinds of crises. And we've seen them for centuries. So I am less willing to say, gee, you could have stopped it, because we've had financial crises as long as man has had economies. And I am less optimistic that it will never happen again. I think it quite likely could.
And your reaction to the those people who argue what this is a fairly spectacular failure of oversight, government oversight.
There is some failure of government oversight, but not exclusively. I mean, we had many of these institutions who were absolutely within their regulated capital standards. They were absolutely in compliance with everything the government asked them. They fell apart spectacularly. So something more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. What about, and I think that there are people who would want to agree with your one Republican colleague that dissented from you and your other two in saying that one of the big problems here was a fairly aggressive promotion of home ownership by government, and that there were people who ended up buying homes that truly couldn't afford them and shouldn't have gotten the loan in the first place.
There are certainly housing policy contributed to this. We don't disagree with that. We just think you needed more than just that. And there are things that are good and bad ideas, and there are things that did not cause the crisis. I personally think it's not a good idea to have aggressive government promotion of debt-financed owner-occupied housing. That's what the mortgage interest deduction does. It says, we're going to give you a break if you're in debt and own a home. Why? Community Reinvestment Act. A clear push to give lower-income individuals mortgages who would not otherwise qualify. But both of those have been around forever, and nothing changed, and now we have a crisis. So those may or may not be good ideas, but we don't think they caused the crisis. The only thing in that changed over time that might have pushed things were the affordable housing goals for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where they had to make sure that a fraction of their mortgages were hitting people at the lower end of the income spectrum. And that's that is a contributor, but it wasn't just that. You needed more.
Yeah. Well, maybe at some point we'll talk some more about changes in the tax structure at the federal level. But since you just raised the mortgage tax deduction, let me just ask you about that. Would you say that that's something that should be eliminated?
If you're writing a tax code from scratch, I do not think you would include that. And I, as you know, a professional economist, understand its enduring appeal, and I understand the politics of how impossible it is to get rid of, but you wouldn't put that in a tax code if you're starting from scratch.
No. So it's one, probably got to be one of the most popular and one of the most widely, broadly used deductions that are in the federal tax code.
No question about that. But in the end, what it says is we want to subsidize you being in debt to own a home, and why not rent? What is un-American about renting? And you have to answer several basic questions, which are, number one, do we want to subsidize housing? If we want to subsidize housing, do we want to subsidize even more owner-occupied housing as opposed to renting, and why? And if we want to subsidize owner-occupied housing, do we want to only subsidize debt financed? If people, you know, have, you know, paid off their mortgages, they get no tax break. And why? And finally, do you want to have an open-ended subsidy, one that is not budgeted, it just turns out to be as big as it's going to be, and which is more valuable to rich people than it is to poor people? Those are all questions where you have to answer, yeah, we want to do that in order to keep the mortgage interest deduction the way it is.
Going back to the commission, you said that you thought actually there would be some the value in having gone through the process, because at least what people can do is they can go back and they can look at it all, look at the whole record, look what everybody thought, and decide, well, okay, what do you think? I'm sure that there were people who voiced, I know that there were because I read it, voiced some disappointment afterwards and said, well, you know, this is another one of those commissions. They had their hearings, they issued this big report, and it's going to go sit on a shelf, and that's going to be it. You actually think there might well be some enduring value for having gone through this whole thing?
I guess I hope so. I mean, I spent a lot of time on this, year and a half of my life, and I'm disappointed by the outcome. I actually did think that we had a chance at the outset to come to a unanimous nonpartisan report. We didn't. One hopes there's enduring value. We were never asked to make policy recommendations. We were never asked to come up with what the Congress or the administration should do. And so our enduring value was always going to be an explanation to the American people of this horrible event. And they didn't get a single one. They got three. But I still think that's going to provide some value as they sort through it.
Well, if you had been asked, okay, now what is going forward now? What should we do if we have some hope of trying to keep such things from happening again?
In the end, I think there are two very simple lessons of financial crises. One, it turns out we did not have big banks, big financial institutions in general, holding enough capital so that if they had some losses, they had a backstop with which to pay off those losses. And number two, we didn't have set up the ability of a Federal Reserve to be the lender of last resort outside of traditional banking, even though there was a lot of activity outside of traditional banking. We have fixed some of those problems. I mean, worldwide capital standards are going up, and the Federal Reserve in the crisis invented and now has received authorization from the Congress to be the lender of last resort to a wider variety of institutions so that when money gets tight and people panic, which is really what happened in the end, they can do what central bankers have always done in a panic, which is flood the system with money and let everyone calm down.
So you think that what's in place now is enough so that if a big financial institution makes some sort of risky move and ends up losing money, that the requirement is that they can cover it, that they have enough cash on hand to cover it?
Not quite. We are made steps in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We think they're going to hold enough capital against reasonable losses, but the only way to be 100% sure is to never have any debt and have 100% capital, and we're not there. So you know, this you can't rule out a 100-year flood, and you can't rule out the possibility we're going to see big financial institutions in distress. And one of the things we didn't fix, and which is very hard, and I don't have a simple answer for, is what to do with these enormous financial institutions. They're now more concentrated and bigger than they were before in a crisis. Every policymaker, Republican, Democrat I've ever met in a crisis is very risk-averse. They are not going to let one of these institutions fail. And so the too-big-to-fail problem remains with us, and we have not solved it.
Well, do you have some disagreement with the too-big-to-fail notion? That is,
no. I would love to have a world where nothing was too big to fail and we let things fail all the time, but we're not there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is economist Douglas Holtz Aiken, and she is widely experienced in Washington. He served as a chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisers to President George W. Bush. He was also director of the Congressional Budget Office. He was one of the members of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that was appointed to look into the crisis of a couple of years ago. Some people, I suppose, say it's in some ways it's still going on. He was an advisor to the McCain presidential campaign 2008. He's here visiting the campus, gave a talk, was going to be spending some more time, and was good enough to come and sit with us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. The big topic of conversation, obviously, now in Washington is the federal government, its size, how it spends money. We have people in the Congress now, Republicans particularly, and some of them recently elected Republicans, who feel that they have a mandate to aggressively cut government spending as a way of also trying to deal with this enormous deficit that we have. And I think that it's not so much, I think, that people, either there are some people who say, oh, deficit's not a problem. I think, though, that there are some people who say, well, the question is, how quickly do you have to move to deal with your deficit? So let me ask you, yes, is deficit a problem? And then, well, how aggressive do you need to be in moving on it?
It's an enormous problem. The easiest way to see this is to look at either this year or last year's president's budget and dial the clock forward to 2020, 2021, 10 years from now. And in those budgets, the economy is assumed to be back to full employment. We got unemployment in the 5% range. The financial crisis is a distant memory. We are no longer fighting overseas wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And revenues are well above their historic norms. They're at 19 or 20% in this year's budget of national income. And despite that, we have trillion-dollar deficits. That's unacceptable. Over the course of the next decade, if those budgets are really the plan, this country will cross the line where it will be downgraded as a sovereign borrower and no longer have a AAA rating. It will be the case that in 2021, we are borrowing essentially enough to just pay interest on previous borrowing, which means we will be entering into what is essentially a debt spiral where we're just continually issuing debt to cover previous debt. That's a recipe for economic stagnation, if not a crisis, and it's a recipe, since we're borrowing from people who don't share our values, for threats to our freedom. So this is an enormously big deal, and it cannot be underestimated how unfair it is to the next generations to leave behind an economy that would be damaged and freedoms that would be impaired. It would be a failure of the most fundamental sort. And the president's commission that he set up called this a national moment of truth, one that would require that we stop deferring hard decisions, that we stop playing political games with budgets, and that we deal with the problem as they identified it, which is the spending in the federal government. It would have to be all kinds of spending. Everything would have to be on the table. We would have to move aggressively and quickly. And that if there was to be more revenue, there had to be tax reform to get it. And those were the four main lessons of that commission. So I don't think you can possibly look at this in any clear-eyed way and come to any other conclusion than, yes, you got to cut some spending, and it's time to start now.
Yeah. Well, what about those people who would say, well, what the Congress has done so far, this budget that they passed out of the House and sent to the Senate a week ago, the things that it cuts, it finds a lot of things to cut. But they're individually small things. Now, I suppose you can argue that, well, that does indeed add up, but that the big problem, the most difficult problem, are the places where the big money are, that are programs that have very strong constituencies and are going to be very, very difficult. Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, defense.
So to be fair, what's gone on in the House is they haven't passed a budget. They are working on this year's funding, for which Congress never passed a budget, and where they are operating on a stopgap funding bill, and where only a small bit of the budget is actually in play, and that's the annual appropriations, and they've cut relative to the what the president wanted from both defense and non-defense, and more on the non-defense side, and in the end, these cuts are trivial. This is going to change actual federal spending in 2011 by about $30 billion in a $15 trillion economy. And the ratio of noise to reality here is enormous. I say all the time, I'm living for the day when a Congress cuts so aggressively that we need to worry about endangering the recovery. I mean, that's just, we've never seen any Congress, Republican or Democrat, be willing to do that. So that's a start. It's something they can change now. The big programs are hard, are both politically hard, and they are also slow to change because they're built off the demographics and the aging of the population. So do that. Now let's roll the clock forward. We're starting on the 2012 budget. That's looking forward. Yeah. That really should be at the heart of this. They have said they'll take on entitlement reform. We'll see. From my point of view, the most important thing to do would be to do something on Social Security. And the reason is that it has no impact on people now. Social Security is all about our kids and whether a program will survive to be a safety net for them or not. The solutions to it are relatively well known. There have been many Social Security reform plans. If we did that, we would show we could take on entitlement reform. That'd be a good thing for our international lenders to see, the idea we're willing to tack in the right direction instead of head down the path we're on. And as a matter of reality, when they passed the Affordable Care Act, the Health Reform Act, they intertwined into it Medicare and Medicaid changes. And so if you're unwilling to touch the Affordable Care Act, which the president has said you cannot go after, you've taken the other entitlements off the table. That's a mistake in my view, but that's politically where we are.
So as far as I have some calls, shall we get right to them, I promise. As far as Social Security is concerned, people have been arguing now for years is it in trouble? Is it not in trouble?
It's in trouble.
If it's going to be in trouble, when, and what to do. And well, I think it certainly is true that now, just fairly recently, the Congressional Budget Office has said now in 2010, for the very first time, more money was being paid out than was coming in.
Yes.
So that's the point at which people had been saying, sooner or later, we're going to get to this point. Well, we're there. What is it that you think that we should do?
My bumper sticker on Social Security reform is get Doug Holtzhagen. I am 53 years old. I am the trailing edge of the baby boom generation. I am, by any measure, an affluent, lucky human being. And you should change my Social Security benefits because, A, it's fair, I can afford it. B, the way Social Security is currently configured, I will get a much bigger retirement benefit than current retirees get. And you can fix the system by giving me more than current retirees get, but less than I was promised. And that seems like a win-win situation. You preserve the system for the future, and you still give people a better benefit in retirement than they got before. And if you don't fix my benefits, you've grandfathered the baby boom generation, which means you've grandfathered the problem. So get Doug Holtzhagen.
So what we're talking about is for people like you, well, for everybody, I assume that it means that people are going to be paying, probably going to be paying more in. There may be more of a kind of means test on what you get out. Chances are the age at which you can collect your benefits, we're going to push it even farther in the future. That's what we're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, you can do this without paying more in, but you have to change some side of the equation. Either more goes in or less comes out. The real fixes, I think, ought to be on the spending side. That's what the Bowles-Simpson Commission pointed to as the fundamental problem in the federal budget. And Social Security is already, quote, means tested in that if you're a high lifetime earner, you get back less per dollar that you put in than people who are low lifetime earners. And if you just make that more aggressive and do some other fixes, you can preserve this system for the future.
So there is a cap. You're talking about
in the benefit formula when you start calculating benefits, you get essentially a replacement for your wages, and the replacement rate is initially pretty high, but then goes down. So the more you're earning in your lifetime, the less you're going to get in a replacement rate. That's a means test by any other name.
Okay.
So label it what you want, change the formula, fix the system, move on.
We got some callers here. Let's talk with them, starting with Spring Bay, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Well, the meltdown in 2008 hit at the same time that oil hit an all-time high. And So the question becomes, if we become constrained with access to energy, how do we continue a growing economy? And if energy is figured into the foundation of the economy and it becomes constrained, then do we have to start to reconsider our thoughts about growth and perhaps change the model to a steady state economy in a new environment of energy constraints? And I'll get off and let you chew on that a little bit.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Certainly, I think you're right in that what we saw in summer of 2008 was oil hit about $140 a barrel. It had a very significant impact, as it has historically had a significant impact on the U.S. economy. There was open conjecture that we might enter a recession, and then the financial crisis eliminated all question about that. We had a very severe recession. So our exposure to oil price shocks has, over the entire post-war period, and certainly since the 70s especially, been associated with economic problems. And I, for one, would love to see us develop a coherent strategy to move away from a reliance on oil, because much of it will end up being imported oil, and as a result, take away both the national security threats we get from the oil supply pipelines, and basically our imported oil supply lines are exposed to terrorist events. We've seen numerous attempts in Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries. Those are all targeted at harming the U.S. economy and thus harming us. The oil that we buy, we finance some terrorism with. We have economic exposures. It strikes me as a very good and rational thing to develop a coherent policy to move away from that. We've never really done that in the United States. We have lots of piecemeal subsidies for biomass here, wind there, solar there. But we've never really come to grips with this, and it would be, I think, a desirable thing to do. I don't think that comes at the expense of growth, though. I mean, we can power this economy in a variety of ways, powering it in a safer and, sort of less exposed fashion would be desirable, and we can still meet our growth objectives. And I think we have to genuinely focus on growth in ways that we might not willing in the past have been willing to, because we have 8 million people out of work. Economies that have had financial crises typically recover relatively slowly. It takes 4 or 5 years. They don't bounce right back. We're in that position. And we should be at every juncture asking the question, will this policy help us grow faster and put people back to work, or will it not? And if the answer is not, we should pass it up. Mm-hmm. It's the top priority.
Well, I know that some people have disagreements about what the Congress is talking about now in terms of spending to get us through the rest of fiscal 11,
yep.
And whether or not that's going to be bad or good or otherwise. People argue about the degree, but I think everyone agrees that it's going to have some effect on recovery. If we have a big now and we're having a spike in oil prices as a result of what's going on in the Middle East, it seems that that doesn't add up to – that's not a very good situation, at least if you're looking now what's likely to happen for the rest of this year.
Well, I certainly think the oil price spike is something to watch and be concerned about. We've seen the history on that. It's utterly compelling. I am less convinced that all the talk about what the House passed would go through the Senate and be signed by the president, what the implications would be. Mm-hmm. I've done the arithmetic on what actually flows out of the government in terms of cuts. Remember, one of the things we learned with the stimulus episode is, you know, you can say you're going to spend the money, but it takes a long time for it to get out. The same is true in reverse. You can say you're going to cut the money, it takes a long time for the cuts to happen. So this isn't going to happen instantly. The notion that when you cut spending, you send the signal that we're not going to have a future riddled with higher interest rates or higher taxes or both is good for business, and so there are going to be offsets on the business side. I think if you take at face value the idea that it's going to be bad and try to get the magnitude right, you're talking about 0.3%. It's nothing. It's just rounding error in economic growth. And if there are offsets from the private sector, we're fine.
Yeah. And I suppose it's also one should make the point that I don't think that anybody really thinks that what has passed the House is going to pass the Senate.
I would say that's a fair political forecast.
The Senate's not just going to say, okay, fine.
Done.
And sign off on it.
Right. That doesn't appear to be in Harry Reid's DNA.
Yeah, probably. And then we do have the president to reckon with. Let's go next to another caller, and this would be Belgium, line 2. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Yes.
If I I hope I didn't understand, I misunderstood you, but I heard you to say that the Iraq and Afghan wars have been solved. Sir, those are some of the major problems in our budget. We are spending not billions, but trillions of dollars there. And that money comes right out of our pockets first. That seems to be a place where we could solve a lot of our problems.
What I did say was that in the president's budget, which he published recently, if you run the clock forward a decade from now, it is presumed that those wars have been wrapped up and they are no longer a budgetary phenomenon.
2020.
That's 10 years from now. I was not talking about today.
Well, the problem is today, sir, and we're spending that money today.
The problem is certainly today, but it is more important, I think, to recognize that we are on a trajectory to disaster. And what we have to do today is change course. If I think anyone who, again, looks at this in a clear-eyed way recognizes it's going to be defense, non-defense, entitlements. There isn't a part of the federal budget that can or should be immune from the necessity of getting us on a more sustainable trajectory.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, we'll go on, and we'll go next to a caller on our line number one, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Going back to Social Security, it seems to me that you have to take into account that there are no longer private retirement programs. Those have been more or less done away, except in the public sector, where they're heavily under assault. But a very large segment of the population is financially incapable of saving enough for their retirement. One suggested solution has been to raise the retirement age. I expect, with your knowledge, that you're aware of the fact that while the overall life expectancy has gone up, for the lower income segment of the population, it has not gone up. So effectively, you're reducing the amount that they can expect, and also many of these people are going to be in a position to continue working, and if they were physically able to work, there aren't any jobs for them to perform. So raising the retirement age seems callous. As for saving money in a 104, that's a good idea. And when I was working, I managed to put away about a quarter of my gross earnings that way. But if you're quite low income, you can't. And even if you do, you must acquire much larger assets. You really can't take out more than about 4% of what you've put in at one time, that is, in 1 year, or you reduce your capital. You won't keep up with inflation, and over years you'll have a declining accumulation to withdraw from, so that you it's a much less reasonable way of going about it. With Social Security, you can calculate the actuary numbers, and you can take out a larger amount from the pool and not have the problem of running out of money for any individual. Would you care to comment?
A lot of different issues there. I mean, number one, I think it's important to recognize that Social Security reform is not about current retirees or near retirees. It is about, let me finish, please.
Yeah.
And it is fundamentally about our kids and the kind of system that they will have when they retire. That means that at the same time, we do need to come up with an alternative in the private savings system. Social Security was never envisioned as the sole source of retirement income. We have seen the American experiment with defined benefit pension plans come and go. I think that's over. We don't have broad pension coverage in the private sector in either IRAs, 401ks, or whatever defined contribution version you like. So I am utterly sympathetic to the notion that you should pair with Social Security reform a real hard look at private saving and to make sure that that same generation arrives at the new Social Security system with the other legs of the traditional stool, which are private saving and a pension plan. That's utterly got to be part of our strategy, and I completely agree with that.
Well, the savings is very, very good for upper-income people, but for the lower three-quarters of the population, which includes most of us but probably not you, this is not feasible. It just isn't possible to save enough.
Again, many reforms and the ones that I would favor include an increase in the minimum benefit pegged to the federal poverty level to make sure that we have a safety net that in the end mirrors what we've chosen for those during their working careers. And I think that's a sensible idea. But the underlying reality that Americans now need to face is that their notion of just continuing with what we have is not going to work. That ultimately, the scale of the promises in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the new Affordable Care Act dwarf the capacity of this economy to both grow and pay those benefits. And we will do a disservice of the most fundamental sort if we pretend that that's not true, damage the economy and our freedoms, and deliver to our children not just broken programs, but a broken nation. And that is unacceptable.
May I comment? First, we have a greater more disproportionate distribution of wealth today than we have had at any time since the 1920s, and that is growing. Paying out to these programs helps to reverse this. And I would suggest the way to mend Social Security is to raise the cap on contributions. Double it. This has both the effect of somewhat alleviating gross inequalities in wealth and also will repair the Social Security system. As for Social Security never having been envisioned as a retirement program or a complete one, you're right, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be. We've learned a lot, and one of the things we've learned is you can't trust industry to provide retirement. Companies are change management, and they simply do away with the pension programs.
I actually agree that I don't think we should pretend that our industries, our companies, whether they're local, national, or global, should be vessels for social welfare benefits. I don't think that's a role that they should have. I think it was a mistake to burden them with that. But the reality we face is that regardless of what you and I might think about the fairness of the distribution of who pays for government programs, we are on track to have the programs that I described, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the new Affordable Care Act, rise to be larger than the current size of the entire federal government in and of themselves and then beyond. If you layer on the traditional roles of government, education, basic research, national defense, infrastructure, we will have a federal government that is more than twice the size that it currently is, taking something that looks like 35% to 40% of our national income. If we try to raise taxes to do that, we will crush the U.S. economy. It's not a matter of anything other than common sense. So the naive notion that, gee, we can just raise taxes and solve this problem is defeated by the arithmetic. And that's a tough moment, but it's true.
I really have to jump in here. We just have about 10 minutes left. I have another caller. And we'd like to introduce again our guest, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He's an economist. He served as chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors. This was for President George W. Bush, 2001-2002. He was also director of the Congressional Budget Office. He served as a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, was a chief economic policy advisor to Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. He is now the president of a think tank called the American Action Forum. He's visiting the campus. He gave a talk yesterday. This was the annual Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And we're talking about the economy. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Also toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have another caller here. I believe next would be line three in Champaign. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I think it would be fair to characterize you as a current and past member of the economic policy elite, wouldn't it be?
Probably, yes. I'd say so.
If I went on,
I'd say so, yeah.
Okay. I found your narrative essentially an exercise in justifying the status quo.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. If you could just talk a little slower, that would help me.
I find your narrative essentially an exercise in justifying the status quo. And I would argue that the banking crisis was basically the distortion of the markets caused by the outsized influence of the financial community on the regulatory system and upon the legislative system itself. And then I would go on to make one more point, and then I'll hang up and listen to you. It's fascinating and annoying to me that the Republicans always get religion about, like, cutting benefits to the middle and lower classes when the Democrats are in power, presidentially-wise. And so I'd like to listen to your comments. Thank you.
Well, there's not really a question there, so we can agree to disagree about the cause of the financial crisis. Our dissent is 27 pages long, easily readable. I'd encourage people to take a look at it. The caller's comments are closer to the narrative of the majority, and I don't think match the facts. In terms of the role of parties in getting religion about cutting spending, neither has shown any real affection for this task ever. And given that it is now paramount that both develop at least a willingness, if not an affection for it, I wait with bated breath to see if we really do take on, as you pointed out, the big programs and put them on a sustainable track. The jury's out. We had in 2000, and certainly when I was at CBO in 2003, you could have predicted all these problems. I said the same things then that I'm saying now about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. We wasted a decade without fixing. In Medicare's case, we made it worse. And then we had a financial crisis where we gave up our cushion. We had to borrow an enormous amount. So we've now wasted a decade. We lost our time and our cushion, and the pressure's up. We'll see how everyone responds.
Well, we talked earlier about the fact that here at this point in Congress, what they're doing is they're just trying to get us through the rest of fiscal 2011.
Niggling at the edges, I would describe this.
And then comes the big, comes the even bigger challenge of, okay, what are you going to do about that fiscal 2012? That'll be the fiscal year that begins in,
October 1st. Yes.
And we both said, well, one thing we know is that what the House has passed, the Senate's not just going to pass it. You know, they're going to have to decide what they're going to do. The two houses are going to have to work something out. But so then the question is, well, what do you think is likely to happen here? How do you think this is likely to get worked out? And I'm not talking about just for the rest of 2011, but for 2012.
Well, I mean, one hopes that the various minefields in 2011 get sidestepped. One is the stopgap funding. The idea of closing the government, I think, would be collective irresponsibility. Mm-hmm. And then we have to have a debt limit increase, and that's traditionally an exercise in histrionics in Congress, and one hopes we can get through that without any major, I think the technical term is kerfluffle. And then we turn to the real problems, 2012. And as I said, I believe, international financial markets can look at the United States. They see where we're headed. There's no fooling Mother Nature here. And at some point, we become a bad borrower, and they start demanding higher interest rates from us. They say, that you're not going to get the money you need. That's bad, and we will suffer economically if we go there. So we need to convince them, and we need, for our own purposes, do the right thing by our children to chart a new course. And I think Social Security is important not because it changes the current situation very much, but it says, yeah, we're willing to do the things that, as you point out, we've never been willing to do. We've talked about this for decades. So that, to me, is the hope for 2012, and that's what I'm crossing my fingers about.
All right. We will try to take at least one or two more calls. We have about 5 minutes. Next up, I believe, is line number two, and I think that is Ann Urbana, a caller? Right. Yes. Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. I want to take issue with two things. One, you talked about pegging measures. When you talked about Social Security, I believe pegging measures to federal poverty levels. And I'm sure that you know these are totally unreasonable. A family of four making about $20,000, who can afford that? I think one of the first things we need to do is reexamine the whole issue of poverty. I mean, it's easy to talk about across-the-board cuts, so everybody gets hurt. The millionaire gets hurt. Actually, the millionaire doesn't get hurt. Or just like the people at the bottom. This is a kind of Malthusian notion, which is very, very damaging. Secondly, in the opposition to taxes, the people at the top are not paying their fair taxes. You say, well, if you tax those people, then you damage the economy. This is a line that has been used consistently to avoid every reform that tried to get a fair measure across on taxation and rewards. It was used for minimum wage. If you adopt a minimum wage, you destroy the economy. If you do this, prevailing wage, you destroy the economy. If you raise the poverty level, you destroy the economy. The economy was destroyed by the people of the top. If you look at the past, four administrations, we had the savings and loans that damaged horribly the economy. And those people, the American people, had to pay for that out of their pockets. The people running the savings and loans did not come back and pay for that. It was the banking industry, the investment industry, that this destroyed us now. And it seems to me they're getting off scot-free. It's once again the American people who have to pay that. But talk about a really progressive taxation, not giving the people at the top these tax breaks seems to destroy the economy. This is a refrain we heard over and over again. And I don't think it is science. I don't think it is mathematics. I think it's ideology, which infuses the profession of economics in our society now. And I think that's what's destroying us, the greed that we don't challenge this. We don't have a notion of social solidarity. We don't have a notion of fairness. All we have is a notion of what's going to be good for the economy. And the people who are blamed are always the people at the bottom who are irresponsible, shouldn't have their houses, they can't afford them, and so on.
Well, you've laid out a lot of things, and we only have a couple of minutes here, so I want to give the guest a chance to make some kind of response.
So two pieces of food for thought on the tax issue. My point is simply that if you spend the money, ultimately you have to pay for it, and that's the reality. And if we go from spending 20 cents out of every national dollar at the federal level, which is roughly what we've done traditionally, to 40 cents out of every national dollar at the federal level, which is where these programs will go if left on autopilot, we will have to raise taxes to match. And regardless of who pays them, to double the overall level of federal taxation in the United States would be damaging economically, and I believe that to my core. On the issue of fairness, you can look at fairness a lot of different ways, and that's one of the reasons why it's a perennial debating topic, and people don't agree about it. But remember that the largest tax most people pay is the payroll tax. That's the biggest tax for the majority of Americans. And that goes into Social Security, and it goes into Medicare. And most lower-income individuals, all lower-income individuals, and most individuals get more out of those programs than they put in. So they're net winners. The remainder of government is financed by the income tax, which means all of the traditional functions envisioned by our founders are now paid for by under a majority of Americans. A minority pay the income tax. The top 5% pay half of it, which means we have a tiny fraction of Americans paying for the whole government and the others getting a net redistribution. Is that fair?
There's so many other things we could talk about. We're coming down to the point where we're going to have to finish. So let me ask you, going back to the financial crisis, I think that, as the caller says, that one of the things that makes a lot of people angry is that they're feeling that the people that were responsible for the crisis face no consequences at all, almost no consequences at all. And in fact, that some of them probably are better off now than they were before.
It's true. And the anger is fair. I don't think any policymaker, Republican or Democrat, who's, you know, sort of stepped in and provided public funds for these institutions feels good about it. It was done because the damage to the average American would be worse by having the system fall apart than what was done. But this does allow, and the regular intervention by the government to bail out these too big to fail institutions gives them a license to not be as safe as they otherwise should be. And that's a bad thing. I mean, there's no question about it. It's a problem now. It was a problem before. And it's something I'm not happy about. I don't think anyone should be happy about.
What about income inequality and the fact that it seems to be getting worse in this country and has been for some time? Do you think that's a problem?
It is absolutely the case that we saw it widen for decades, and the bottom has stopped dropping, but the top is continuing to go up. I think this is, at its core, best addressed through two things. Number one is getting our educational system to work. The U.S. kindergarten to 12th grade education system is in crisis. It is underperforming. It's a civil rights issue. It's an economic competitiveness issue. And it is about inequality, because skills are what's driving the inequality. And the second is these savings vehicles talked about earlier. You know, if there's going to be a big rate of return to investments around the globe in a globalized economy, people have to have some of that, the return to that investment, in order to be have a chance. And so we need to build these savings vehicles for everyone.
Maybe one more thing, if you can give me about a minute. What can the government do to stimulate job creation?
There's I think the biggest thing we could do right now would be to, you know, clarify this future. So if you're a business, and we know the business sector has trillions of dollars of cash on its balance sheet, and it's the one part of our economy that it's financially sort of set and able to do something. When it looks out in the future, it sees this enormous yawning debt. It sees the possibility of higher interest rates or higher taxes or both. And it also, you know, has to make reasonable decisions about where it's going to locate things. So this is not a great place to be at the moment. And we can fix it. We can right now take control of our destiny, promise to be more responsible in the future, and I think it would have an enormous impact on the climate and on job creation, and that's got to be the top priority. We have got to grow more quickly.
All right, there we'll have to stop. Douglas Holtz Aiken is our guest. He is an economist. He served as chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors to President George W. Bush. He also served a couple of years as director of the Congressional Budget Office. He was a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. He's president of the American Action Forum. Thank you very much.
Thank you.